Following the false missile alert, a story made the rounds on social media about people who were kicked off a city bus. Oahu Transit Service President and General Manager Roger Morton says he was never able to get to the bottom of this and verify the story. But that got us to thinking not just about what happens to bus users, but the very vulnerable users of the handy van. Charlotte Townsend is a vice president of Paratransit Services and a longtime advocate for the disabled, who also happens to be wheelchair bound.
If my driver started caring about the alert from our passengers, because our drivers do not carry cell phones that they're supposed to operate during the course of their work assignment. So passengers were informing the drivers that they got this alert and what's going to happen and any details that they had. So the drivers didn't know. So their routine is to pull over, call dispatch here. Dispatch wasn't aware of the alert either, since they have no access to cell phones. So we then called Central Control, which is the bus, which is adjacent to our property, and they started calling to emergency management, trying to get an explanation as to what was going on. In the meantime, our drivers on the road were pulling off, waiting for dispatch to give them direction on what to do. It took a while to get any response. Central Control wasn't able to get through to emergency management, so we started to implement an existing policy that we have regarding alerts in general, like a tsunami alert or anything, trying to communicate with our drivers. By the time we started to do that, the alert was canceled, and so our drivers proceeded to take their passengers to their destinations. Now, I got no reports or any incidents where passengers were unduly upset or felt they had to get off immediately. And part of that, I think, was the delay in really understanding what the alert was all about.
Well, now that we know what's happened, what has changed going forward?
Well, company-wide, which would include the bus and the handy van, we're looking at a policy specific to this type of alert. But within our own area of paratransit, I'm trying to identify for them what does it mean to secure in place. And there is a lot of misunderstanding about what that term meant. So we're reviewing that with our operators at this point. And we're trying to, management is trying to come up with places that we can identify where our drivers can go to should an alert like this occur, following the recommendations of a concrete building to get people inside. It would take, unfortunately, longer than 15 minutes, which is our window, to get our wheelchair passengers off the van. So to unload them into a protected facility would be very difficult. So we're looking at in place being things like under Nimitz Highway or on Nimitz Highway, under the freeway, I should say, into the tunnels, the Poly H3 Likelike, into trying to name facilities or places throughout the island that should our handy van be close to those areas, that they would automatically go there. Giving a name or a place to our drivers that they can think of, but most of them thought securing in place meant to go home and stay home. So I think by having a better understanding of what the word means and places that they could go to shelter down until we get further direction is where we're at currently. And then the policy will be redrafted, or actually drafted, because we never had one to begin with for this type of alert.
How many drivers you have out on the road every day? You know, how many vans are on our streets?
We have approximately 170 vans a day out. I figured we had between 40 and 50 vans on the road with passengers during the time of the alert.
And we're talking about servicing a segment of the population that is vulnerable,
right,
because of their physical disabilities. And I don't know what the average time is to unload a passenger on a wheelchair in one of those vans. Is it
about 10 minutes? 10 to 12 minutes, depending on the size and the vehicle.
Right. And so if the warning says you have 15 minutes, you've got to find a place to drive to quickly.
Right. And that's why we're trying to plant the seed in their head about what kind of locations would be appropriate, so they could make that decision on the spot, pending where they are when the alert is issued.
So what was going through your mind when you got the alert? that morning?
When I went to the alert, I got a call from a family member who was kind of panicked, and I just said, I don't hear any sirens. I'm that old that I remember doing alerts under the desk in school. If you don't hear a siren, don't worry about it. And I went, kissed my husband goodbye, and we went back to sleep. And about a few seconds later, I jumped up because I had to worry about my drivers. And then I was on the path to communicate with my drivers and paratransit. But my initial thought was to go back to bed.
Well, you didn't know if it was a real thing, I guess, right?
Yeah, I didn't know if it was a real thing. I did get the alert. But, you know, as I mentioned, I'm kind of programmed by the alert signal and what the different tones of the alert mean growing up with that, you know, every first working day of the month. When I did not hear that, I just directed my family to wait it out, and then I started on my job.
So going forward, you've now identified this need for a policy to put in place, identify
yes.
areas where the drivers could go too quickly to get to shelter.
Mm-hmm. It'll be an overall policy for, like I said, both the bus and handy van, but it'll be different as far as how we implement that, because on the bus, people apparently want to get off the bus and go on their own way, whereas for our paratransit, we'd have to keep them contained.
And this policy of not allowing the drivers to have their cell phones with them, I'm sure it discourages texting and calling when they should be
yes.
attention on the road. But we talked to other industries, the hotel folks, and I guess they're wondering if their housekeepers should have their phones for those types of alerts, or if, as an example, if there was an active shooter on a hotel floor, you know, that they would at least have some means mm-hmm. of calling for help. Is there any thought about reconsidering?
Well, we haven't not thought of the idea of cell phones. Many of my drivers have their own personal cell phones with them throughout the day. They're just not able to use them for work purposes. So
oh,
I think we need to address that because they do carry them, the majority of my drivers do. So I think it's going to be a discussion point on the table between the bus and us as to what our formal policy is going to be about that. But now, especially that we have on our communication tool on the vans that able to communicate through that tablet and do massive text to our drivers, that's somewhat of a safety cushion for us, so we can get the alert out to them a lot faster. But we have not rejected the idea of them carrying a cell phone that they have permission to use at certain times.
Okay, but certainly this missile mistake is causing everyone to reevaluate their systems and to ask, how ready are we?
It had an impact to us, and we're taking it very seriously. We're part, you know, of the solution when it comes to other alerts like tsunami and transportation and getting people to safe places. So, you know, we're part of that system, and you know, it's just coincidental, if not, well, maybe that's not the right word, but normally central control would be on the list of emergency management and the police to notify us on any kind of alert like that, and we didn't get anything.
Okay. Well, Charlotte Townsend, thank you for joining us and sharing this. Gives us another glimpse into the needs of this community when an emergency arises like this. But thanks again.
Yes. Well, you're very welcome. It's keeping us on our toes, that's for sure.
That was Charlotte Townsend, Vice President of Paratransit Services, sharing the changes that are being made as a result of last month's false missile alert. We're continuing to hear from you about the Hawaii Emergency Management Agency's ability to accurately notify the public of a threat. Gail from Honolulu wrote in, at the risk of beating a dead horse, I'd like to hear about the decision-making process on why the patch to add a ballistic missile warning was added to an antiquated alert system in the first place. What mainland software consultant convinced Miyagi that this was needed? In addition, we haven't heard from intelligent experts about the destructive capability of NK warheads, nor NK's launch delivery systems, both of which I understand have very little probability of success. Hope you revisit this topic again as we learn more.
And Donald Chalk wrote, I had hoped that the Aloha State would have been past the pointing finger stage a couple of weeks ago, and instead focus on the opportunity to learn from our mistakes and make the system better. It would be fascinating to do a comparative study of Japan's response to their false alarm incident and see if they have as much blaming behavior going on among the public, media, and politicians. Thanks for listening. And here are a few of your comments from our talkback line.
Hello, this is Judy Eagle on Maui. And with regard to trusting Hawaii Emergency Management, sure, generally, hey, everything is getting reported as an emergency. At any rate, to have one individual not weeded out, not separated to doing non-urgent tasks, that is a concern. So presumably supervision will be a key to this also. Aloha.
I don't believe enough's been done to address the situation of the emergency management system in Hawaii. In any other organization, the people responsible would have been immediately terminated, and a full investigation by a third-party independent source would have been undergone. What we got was foot-dragging, tepid explanations, and we still don't know what happened. It's comical, and it makes us look like Keystone Cops.
I think that maybe the wrong person was fired. They should investigate the supervisor who gave that warning, exercise, this is not a drill. That kind of behavior is reckless and illogical. That person should be fired.
Thanks for sharing your stories with us. You can call our talkback line and leave your comments. Here's the number, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, the challenges that Air Force Secretary Heather Wilson must face. But first, your quiz.
In today's backyard quiz, we're thinking of one of Hawaii's native species, one that's severely threatened. It's a raptor that once was plentiful on Hawaii Island, Molokai, Oahu, and Kauai at one time, but now can only be found on the Big Island. It still breeds there, making its home in the strands of Ohia Lehua trees. It's solitary and highly territorial. Like others of its species, it has exceptional eyesight. It can perch on a branch and keep an eye out for prey, prey that includes rats, small birds, stream animals, crickets, praying mantises, millipedes, centipedes, lizards such as Jackson chameleon, and occasionally worms. In the past, it fed on the Hawaiian crow, which is now extinct in the wild. Its call is shrill and high-pitched and sounds a bit like its Hawaiian name. And that's the name we're looking for. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Aloha, I'm Marcia Rose Joyner. If you like today's music, go to the conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org for a playlist.
Another government shutdown is looming this week. The deadline to increase the federal government's spending limit is Thursday. 5 months into the current fiscal year, Congress has yet to pass an annual budget and is instead using short-term spending bills called continuing resolutions to fund the government. That method of accounting hits every part of the U.S. government, making it almost impossible for agencies to plan. And nowhere is that problem more acute than at the U.S. Defense Department. Air Force Secretary Heather Wilson was in Hawaii last week following a trip to Asia. She spoke with HPR's news director Bill Dorman about the impact of an unpredictable budget plan.
I can't maintain the military and the readiness that we need on a continuing resolution. And we need a budget to build a more lethal force. There's just no question about that. And we're now going to come up on 4 or 5 months into a fiscal year. And the most important thing that Congress can do for us is to lift the defense caps and get us a year-long budget.
You know, you're in a unique position because you have congressional experience yourself. And in fact, you bring an unusual background to your position, not only as a graduate of the Air Force Academy and an officer, but a member of the National Security Council staff at one point, but also as a member of Congress for 11 years. How does that perspective inform what you do now? And how does that, where you're sitting now, how would you talk to your former colleagues?
Well, I do talk to my former colleagues frequently, and I think most of them who are focused on national security issues understand completely. But there were times when I was serving where there were continuing resolutions, but generally not for 4, 5, 6 months of the year. So we just need to get back to regular order and take the budgeting process off of cruise control and let the Congress drive this thing.
And assuming the budget situation gets back to a more of a normal planning situation, when it comes to the strategic planning that you do as Secretary of the Air Force, what are your priorities as far as initiatives during your time as Secretary?
The first one is to be ready and to be prepared, to prepare a really trained, well-equipped, and lethal force to protect the vital national interests of the country. And so that's job one for the Air Force and really for all of the services. But the second is cost-effective modernization. If you look at the Air Force over the next 10 years, we have modernization across the board. It's fighters and bombers and tankers and space assets. There's a lot of modernization going on in the Air Force, and we need to make sure that we get those capabilities at a great value and get them on time. And the final thing, really, and it's one of the reasons I'm in the Pacific, is to strengthen our relationships with allies and partners. We have a mutual interest in a stable and prosperous region where rules-based international order is respected. And one of our strengths is that we do have allies. And our primary adversary in the Pacific, China, really doesn't.
Another issue in the Pacific, certainly, and the Korean Peninsula. A bit about the Air Force role within the United States-North Korea strategy. What sort of scenarios is the service working with, and has that changed in the recent past?
Well, North Korea poses a threat to really all nations in the region and beyond. The Air Force is supporting the diplomatic efforts, and we obviously provide military options to the president should diplomacy fail. But the strategic goal that Secretary Tillerson is trying to achieve is a verifiable denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. And everything that the United States Air Force is doing is intended to support his diplomatic effort and give it credibility.
You know, here in Hawaii, certainly the Pacific Missile Range facility is Navy, but the Air Force has a big role in defense here, from satellite tracking to intelligence, other functions. How do you look at the North Korean situation from the perspective of Hawaii these days?
Well, Hawaii is a very important base. Hickam Air Force Base is important for the United States Air Force. And there is no question that the Pacific as a region and the Indo-Pacific is strategically important to the United States, as well as really to the world. I mean, you think about it, 40% of the world's GDP comes from the Indo-Pacific, almost over half of the world's population. So it's strategically important to the United States, and Hawaii is part of that.
There's a review right now within the Trump administration of the nuclear situation, for lack of better phrasing. A lot of that falls under the Air Force in terms of long-range bombers, in terms of ICBMs. From your perspective, what is important to bear in mind as the administration makes these considerations?
The nuclear posture review was actually released, I think, today in Washington. And most of it is classified, but the nuclear posture review looks at our nuclear strategy and force posture and what needs to be done. This posture review really reflects, there's more continuity than change there, and it's very consistent with the history of American nuclear strategy and policy over the long term. It's the Air Force does maintain two of the three legs of the nuclear triad, the air-based and ground-based legs. And so our responsibility is to make sure that the nuclear deterrent is safe, secure, and effective. We also have about three-quarters of the nuclear command, control, and communication systems, and we need to make sure that those are modernized as well. And when I mentioned modernization across the board, of course, the B-21 bomber and the ground-based strategic deterrent, as well as nuclear command and control, are also three elements of that modernization.
You know, you mentioned previously space assets of the Air Force. The U.S. Space Command is under the Air Force, and in some of our near-peer competitors, there is a separate agency for the military in space. What are your thoughts on that? Would that be something that would be useful for the United States from your perspective?
The United States Air Force has been the one that has provided space capabilities to the Joint Force since the 1950s. We operate about, I think it's 12 constellations now, everything from missile warning and communications and command and control to GPS for the world. In fact, that little blue dot on your phone is provided by a squadron of about 40 young people out of Colorado Springs, Colorado. So the Air Force has provided that and really is the envy of the world with respect to space capabilities. The challenge today is that our adversaries know it, that we own the ultimate high ground, and they're developing capabilities to threaten that. So one of the things that that really is changing in the Air Force is that we're developing the ability. We have to be able to defend our satellites on orbit and be able to take a punch and keep on providing the support that the joint force depends upon us for. That actually requires more integration with the different military services than separation. And so anytime anyone starts saying, hey, there should be a separate force, my view is they're probably going in the wrong direction. It needs to be integrated, not separated.
You know, a broader question in terms of the U.S. economy right now, unemployment very low. I'm wondering about challenges that poses for the Air Force in recruiting and if you're planning any specific policies to address that.
We actually, the Air Force does not have a problem recruiting. We're expanding the size of the service this year. We're growing our end strength, and I think we're on track to bring in the airmen that we need, exceptionally highly qualified airmen, both officer and enlisted. And, of course, the Air Force has never, we've always been an all-volunteer force. No one was ever drafted into the Air Force, even in the 40s and 50s and 60s. So it's always been an all-volunteer force of very, very high quality. We are having some challenges retaining air crew, particularly at about the 10 to 15-year point in their careers. So we've got an air crew crisis task force that is looking at that specific problem. That really has to do with the quality of service and being able to balance work and life, or Air Force service and family life in particular. And a lot of that is because the Air Force got too small for what the nation was asking, and surge became the new normal, and air crew just can't keep doing that forever.
I understand that promotions within the Air Force are happening more quickly than historically has been the case and at a much higher rate of approval than usual. Is that part of that retention challenge that you're talking about?
In fact, there hasn't been a lot of change there. With respect to officers, we found that 96% of captains were being promoted to major, but we were requiring every captain to have, there was a whole lot of paperwork for commanders to recommend their captains for promotion, and 96% of them were being promoted. So we kind of flipped this around and said to commanders, if you don't think you're a captain, should be promoted, you should say so, instead of, and it gets back to trying to reduce the burden of meaningless paperwork on airmen. How can we free up white space on their calendar so that they can spend more time focusing on things that really matter, leading troops rather than filling out paperwork?
Anything else that you'd like to add?
I think you've probably covered most of the things. This trip through the Pacific for me was really a great opportunity to deepen my understanding of Air Force operations in the Pacific. It had been a while since I had been in the region, and really to reinforce our commitment to our allies in the region. So it was a very good trip, particularly in the Philippines, South Korea, and Japan, but also here in Hawaii.
Madam Secretary, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Heather Wilson is the 24th Secretary of the Air Force, which includes some 660,000 active duty, guard, reserve, and civilian forces. She stopped in Hawaii on her way back to the mainland from the Asia Pacific.
Support for The Conversation comes from Haleakala Waldorf School on Maui and Honolulu Waldorf School on Oahu, serving Hawaii's families from infancy with parent-child programs through high school, now accepting applications at both schools.
People in Hawaii pride themselves on their warm interaction with one another. A hug and a kiss are often seen, even in a formal professional setting, as being well within the bounds of propriety, until they're not. When do such expressions of Hawaii's so-called aloha spirit cross the line into sexual harassment? A sexual harassment complaint filed last week has brought that issue to the foreground, and Chad Blair has the story in today's Reality Check from Civil Beat. Good morning, Chad.
Good morning, Chris.
There's not a clearly defined borderline, or is there?
Well, I think it depends very much on who is making that decision on whether you've crossed a line or whether you haven't. And one of the things that Denby Fawcett says in her opinion piece, and I'm reporting on Denby's piece today, which is her opinion, is that it can matter who is giving the kiss and the hug and who is receiving it and how they are receiving it. And even Denby, who grew up here and knows the custom of hugging and kissing quite well and appreciates it, admitted herself, look, it could be awkward if it's the wrong person, if you will. What we're dealing with, of course, is a very, seems to be a very serious matter. Rachel Wong, the former Department of Human Services head under the Ige administration, she's filed an ethics complaint against Joe Suki, the former House Speaker. We don't quite know all the particulars of that. Wong is not saying too much. Suki's lawyer is saying quite a lot. And it has raised for all of us this sensitive question of when is it appropriate, when is it traditional, when is it going too far?
One of the questions that arose in the wake of that particular complaint, ethics complaint, is that, you know, maybe some of these values are generational. You know, maybe an older generation might think it's appropriate when a younger generation might not. Do you think that might figure in?
You know, I have to admit, I was talking to my mother, who is of a certain generation, over the weekend about this very topic, and mm-hmm. I raised that very point. Someone in their 20s and 30s may look at something different from someone in their 50s and 60s, and she says, look, I'm in my 80s, and I think, you know, there is a concern here about sexual harassment. So while I think it's generally okay to make an assumption about that, I think it very much depends on the I think it depends on the circumstances involved here, and we just don't know. Wong has said, look, I'm not going to say much more other than I think this is going through a process and it's going to lead to the facts. By the way, she stepped down because she said, look, I was not able to do my job advocating for DHS before the legislature. Michael Green, the attorney for Joe Suki, is saying, look, why did you wait 3 years for this? Is the aloha spirit gone? Are we going to have to pass a law that says you can only hug and kiss people that are within your immediate family? So it's a very interesting question. I have my own difficult. I'm wrestling with this myself, as so many people are ever since the Me Too movement broke last year.
Well, it certainly has a lot of people thinking about things they didn't used to think about, so maybe something will change as a result. Thanks a lot, Chad.
Thanks, Chris.
This was Civil Beat political and opinion editor Chad Blair with today's reality check.
One key question with artificial intelligence is, what happens if it's wrong? Not a big deal if the machine's predicting, say, song choices.
But if you made a pedestrian detector that's 99% correct, that sounds good. And then you do the math and think about how many people would die every day if you had, you know, a fleet of those cars, and it's really not very good at all.
Exploring the limits of AI. That's this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Starting at 4.
Honolulu's H power plant burns tons of trash every year, but it also produces a lot of ash that ends up at the landfill. The city has just gone out to bid on a contract to find a way to recycle that byproduct instead of taking up space in the landfill. That's just one of the challenges of managing Oahu's waste. It's quite a balancing act, keeping costs down for the taxpayer and doing what's right for the environment. Lori Kaikina is the city's chief engineer. It's her job to try and do just that.
What we're hoping is the technology now is out there that a company can come and take the ash, that's the residue from H power when we burn our trash, that's really the bulk of what's going to the landfill right now. Reuse that ash beneficially here on island, including the ASR, that's automotive shredded residue. So when we recycle our vehicles, the fluff that, like, on your roof, your seat, the dashboard, that kind of material is going to the landfill right now, and we would want it to go to H power, get burned, and then the ASR is going to the landfill. We want to take that out of the landfill. So the RFP is going to require that whoever bids on this project needs to take both the ASR and the ash out of the landfill, beneficially reuse it on the island.
So no shipping of that material?
Shipping. It's got to be used here on the island. Cleaned, recycled, and repurposed on island.
So what would that be used for? What other types of materials would be recycled from that?
There's another municipality that is using it in the mainland. I should take that back, because that's only the bottom ash. What certain companies are saying they can do is they use it for base course, maybe when we're filling in trenches or with our asphalt, use it there. I'm not sure what else technology they're going to propose.
When will that contract be awarded, you think?
It usually takes maybe about 3 months, 4 months to actually, we have to evaluate, because different bidders are going to put in their, they can propose different ideas, and the city staff is going to have to evaluate what is in the best package, I guess, offered to the city, and evaluate it and select that and then give out the contract. So yeah, I would think between 3 to 4 months.
Okay. Anything else that's new that you folks are doing besides dealing with this ash? Because that has been a sore spot at the landfill.
Right. If we can divert that, wow, that'd be great. So we're trying to deal with the China not accepting that our recyclables are dirty. You know, not that they want pristine. I think what they're asking is doable, is achievable. But I think they've been asking for several years, and we've not been complying. So they've just put the hammer down. We're not going to take any more of your recyclables until it's at a higher, cleaner level. So other countries are stepping in, but they're not as big as China. So that's going to be quickly saturated. When I've asked my counterparts on the mainland, what are you doing? Almost all of them are landfilling. But at least we're lucky we have H power. But the environmentalists, they're not in an uproar that no way are you going to do that. They're kind of open to it as a temporary fix. That, okay, you know, maybe because we're in the bind now and it's costing us so much money to recycle, And you are using fossil fuels to ship to the mainland as a temporary thing, maybe we might be agreeable to go into H power, but it can't be your cure-all forever. And also, they're very interested in source reduction from the start, and we're in full support of that. That makes a lot of sense.
But is that just plastics?
No, all recyclables, plastics, paper, cardboards. Well, we can't really send glass to H-Power or metals, but, yeah, all recyclables.
What's the snapshot on glass at this point? Because a lot of folks just put that in the blue bin, and that gets sorted out in some places, correct?
Yes, and that is actually a negative commodity for us. It costs money to ship it, and a lot of manufacturers actually don't want it. It's not cost-effective to actually clean and use the bottle. They just want to generate a new one. So you're using sources, right, resources to create a new bottle. So it would make sense to reuse the glass, but, it's costing us to recycle it. So what we're going to do is the next RFP that we're going to put out is to use same thing like ash, reuse it on island, and the managing director and myself, we went up to Japan. There's a technology up there that they are using. They grind up that glass, no matter what color it is, and they grind it up with ceramic balls. And they can make different types of dense materials with it. So they're using it as like floatables. It's full of air, and it's like almost like a cinder rock. And they put it on top of lakes or even at treatment plants to help eat up the algae and the odor. They've grind it all the way up to grains. So you can use it as fill material, cement mixing. I was kind of excited about using it at the golf courses or beach replenishment. So there's a lot of potential in that RFP to use the glass on island. So that's the next one we're putting out.
So the new technological advances may really help us.
Yes, absolutely.
That was Lori Kaikina, the director of the City and County of Honolulu's Environmental Services Department. The H Power plant recently expanded its capacity with the addition of a third boiler. A recent audit highlighted that the city is paying a penalty because it doesn't burn enough regular trash under the contract with its operator. Kaikina says it's close, but it is important to underscore that capacity is critical. The city and state expect to increase its housing inventory, which will add to the collection. And a bill to begin charging households a $5 fee for garbage pickup, down for the proposed $10 fee to help offset the costs, is still being considered by the Honolulu City Council. You can listen back and find audio links to the story on our podcast page, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Aloha, I'm Ruth Fletcher from St. Andrew's Schools. We represent the Priory, the Prep, and Queen Emma Preschool. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Stargazer time, our weekly look into the massive universe around our ridiculously small planet, and also what we can look for in the night skies. And as usual, we're turning to the expertise of Christopher Phillips. He's on the line. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What do you have this week?
Hey, Dave. Good to be back. For this week's stargazers, look out for Mars and Jupiter in the evening sky. Also, the moon will be waning this week. And as we approach the weekend, we will start to see a return of dark skies here in the island.
And I understand you have news on a new planet-hunting telescope.
Yes, a brand new telescope facility has come online at the La Silla Observatory Complex in Chile. It's called the Exoplanets in Transit and Their Atmospheres, or EXTRA for short. As the name suggests, this new facility is designed with the purpose of probing the atmospheres of alien worlds as they orbit their star. As a planet passes between our point of view and the alien star, it causes a slight dip in the brightness of the star that could give us clues to the nature of the alien planet.
So this is an optical telescope, yeah?
It is indeed. And it works by using light in the near-infrared part of the spectrum. But there are issues with this kind of infrared astronomy. Infrared light is easily absorbed by the Earth's atmosphere, and so you need to be somewhere high and dry in order to do it, somewhere like La Silla or even Mauna Kea.
And so how many telescopes does this thing have?
Well, it actually has six telescopes, and each one has a mirror with a diameter of just under a meter. But the amazing thing is they are remotely controlled all the way from France.
Wow, so they're in South America, but being controlled in Europe. Is there anything similar happening here on Hawaii Island?
In fact, there is. The Canada-France-Hawaii Telescope and the Gemini North Telescope both operate remotely from their bases on the Big Island.
And does that mean it's basically astronomy's going the way of most other occupations? People are going to be replaced by robots?
Eventually, yes. And interestingly enough, I am currently using a fully robotic telescope in the Canary Islands to observe planets around distant stars. It's pretty amazing and somewhat frightening stuff.
Astronomers, people like you, Christopher, going to be a thing of the past, going the way of the telegram before too long. We're hoping for a lot more longevity with you, though. It's Christopher Phillips, and thank you for the great report.
You're all welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. We'll catch you next week for Stargazer.
Support for Stargazer comes from Ferraro Choi, celebrating its 30th anniversary and more than 29 years of support for Honolulu Sunrise Rotary. Committed to environmentally sustainable architecture and interior design, FerraroChoi.com.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we told you about one of Hawaii's many threatened native species. This one is a predator that feeds on bugs, other birds, small mammals, and lizards, and the occasional worm. Fairly easy to identify in flight because their bodies look fairly bulky relative to their 16 to 18 inch length. They're classified by the International Union for Conservation of Nature as near threatened, but there's currently no evidence of a decline in their population. We asked you for its Hawaiian name, which is Io. In English, it's the Hawaiian hawk. In Latin, it's Buteo solitarius.
And we have a winner today. Congratulations to Brendan Holland from Kaimuki. Our phone lines ran off the hook. People really know they're raptors. That is today's quiz. And if you have one, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
The path to success for a young writer can be a rocky one. You need persistence, dedication, and focus. Aaron Kandel and his twin brother Jordan are on that path. They grew up here, and they're two of the writers for the Disney film Moana. They've also got a number of other projects in the works. Aaron came to our studio to tell us how he found a career doing what he loves.
I wanted to be a writer since I was started reading in first and second grade. And I feel like I'm only just starting to get my feet under me. You know, it's if you want to be a black belt in martial arts, you've just got to kick a lot of boards.
That's right.
Until you learn how to do it. And so for me, it was just lots and lots of reading and lots of writing. And, you know, I had the fortune of great teachers and just great experiences in learning how to be a storyteller. But, you know, what people always talk about is kind of the two main tenets, which I still to this day don't know if I fully understand, which is show, don't tell, and write what you know. And I think those never really landed for me because, you know, you can listen, we were talking about Aaron Sorkin a little earlier, Shakespeare, like those are plays, that's telling, like that's people talking. That's right. That's an effective version. You know, you read the news, that's mainly like journalistic, that's a lot of telling and less showing. Mm-hmm. And that's effective writing as well. And if you write what you know, you'd never have Star Wars because you don't know what a samurai Jedi in space looks like until
you'd be limited by what you know.
You invent it. So to me, it's more about being specific and the specificity of, you know, nobody cares about reading or writing until you make them care. Mm-hmm. And so you have to write something that first you as the audience of one that you're reading your own writing, you have to care about what you're writing. You have to want to write the next word, mm-hmm. the next sentence, the next page. And it's the same when you're reading something or watching something is there's so we live in a world where we're just bombarded by content. It's everywhere now. And we have the whole history of humanity and all the great content that's come before and that's getting created now that life is short, so you want to make sure you're choosing the things that you're interested in and that you're passionate about. Mm-hmm. You're not going to start reading something, and if you're bored, you're not going to keep reading.
Right.
So when you're writing, it's thinking, it's keeping in mind, what am I passionate about? What do I care about? And how do I get somebody else to care? What are the specific words, the structure, the rhythm, the style, the voice. Is it funny? Is it sad? Is it tragic? That I want to infuse into this to get somebody to read the next word, the next sentence, the next page.
And when you're writing something that you're enthusiastic about, it's all too easy to get into the tall weeds and pursue what you want to pursue and kind of leave the audience behind without necessarily knowing you've done it, right?
Well, yeah, that's the danger of falling in love with your own work.
Yeah.
And that's the benefit of having a twin brother to write with, because we largely hate everything we first write. And we have a rule, we call it egoless arguing, where it's a meritocracy, the best idea wins, and we keep chipping at it and rewriting until we make it something that we both agree is good. Mm-hmm. And then hopefully it's something that if we think it's good, other people will think it's good as well.
You know, most writers, without having that twin brother reference, use themselves as that reference. And a lot of writers, and I include myself among them, write a first draft, hate it, and then, you know, can't get past that hating it process. Sometimes it takes somebody else to get you past that, you know, this stinks, but say, well, it does, but there's something in there to keep.
Well, that's the catcher in the rye, right? J.D. Salinger didn't want to publish that book, I believe. Maybe I'm getting this right, but if memory serves, like, he just sat on it because he didn't think it was any good, and it's considered one of the greatest novels ever written, at least in American literature. I think, you know, there's a lot in any field, in any artistry. I think it's good to have objectivity, and it's good to be your own biggest critic. We like to, when we're writing a movie and making a movie, think about who is the Wallace and Statler, to quote the Muppets. Like, who's the critic sitting in the audience that's going to hate your movie the most? What are their criticisms going to be? And mm-hmm. try to answer those questions, or try to speak to and try to capture that person. And bring them in and hook them into the experience of the film if we can.
That's where the arguing with your twin brother has to be egoless arguing, because usually when we hear a criticism like that that's maybe not that well-intended, we get offended and have a fight-or-flight response rather than a how-can-I-make-my-work-better response.
Yeah, I mean, it's a sense of pride and ego. You get wrapped in what you're writing. It's blood and sweat. You're putting energy into it. You
sure.
want it to work. And if somebody tells you it doesn't, you're going to get, you know, there's a sense of defensiveness. And, you know, it's very much like the animation process, what we loved about that. And maybe it's because we're twins and we don't know anything but collaboration. But when you get into animation, you know, it took 900 people over 5 years to make Moana. And that... you can't be so in love with what you did that you're unwilling or unopen to what somebody else is going to bring in. And there's a team, you know, we're just the creative, we're the storytellers. We're starting with the seed of an idea, but you have PhDs in botany, you have oceanographers, you have physicists, you have, you know, people that spend 3 years just creating clouds,
mm-hmm.
A team of people that just made the clouds or just made the bubbles in the shore break when baby Moana is gathering shells. And you think about all these people are bringing in their expertise, their artistry, their opinions, and you have to be open to people elevating an experience and an art form beyond just, you know, you hold the ball while you have it and then you pass it on. It's a team sport.
It'd be foolish to disregard all that expertise, wouldn't it?
It would be foolish and probably ineffective.
It wouldn't help anyway, right?
Yeah.
Was it quite an adjustment getting used to all that level of collaboration, you know, the way things are done in the film industry today?
It was and it wasn't. It wasn't that my brother and I, you know, traditionally are hobbits and we sit in our little hobbit holes and we write and we're the gods of our own world and we get to create the characters and we control that and we don't have to take outside opinions other than our own. So anytime you open that up and you're sitting in a room with 20 people all talking story and, you know, you screen it for the entire studio and everybody from the head of the studio to the janitor can and does give notes and they're all, you know, have value to them.
Yeah.
That's an adjustment process, but for us it was an exciting adjustment process because, you know, we like to be collaborative and, you know, coming as Sons of Iolani, which is very much a one team. That's the motto of that school is sort of embedded in us as artists and storytellers, is how do you make it a shared experience? That's what sitting in a cinema is. It's a shared experience. You're sitting there and everybody around you is sitting individually in their chairs, but they're hopefully having an elevated experience together.
It's clear that you came to Hollywood with the right attitude, because there's so many stories, and you've heard them, of writers who came to Hollywood and, you know, crashed and burned behind that very system that you describe.
I mean, it's a brutal system. I'm not going to lie. It's a war of attrition to become successful in this industry in Hollywood. But I think in any industry, really, it's like you have to, again, kick a lot of boards or bang your head against a lot of boards, or keyboards in our case. And you either have a sense of pride and ego, and that is going to, you know, you'll burn out and fall out because you're just going to get hit by the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune that is being a filmmaker. Or ideally, you have some humility and some sense of worth in your work, but also openness and flexibility to following your passion wherever that takes you.
Aaron Kendall is a screenwriter and journalist and was one of the writers on the Disney film Moana, along with his twin brother, Jordan. You can learn more about the Iolani High School alums and their work on our Facebook page.
One of today's finest acoustic fingerstyle folk and blues guitarists, Andy Kimball, brings his original songs and classic covers to HPR's Atherton Studio on Saturday the 17th. Reserve your seats today for an evening of pure Americana. Call 955-8821 during business hours or go to hprtickets.org. Andy Kimball in the Atherton, sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
We have to go, but up tomorrow, we continue our conversation with the city's chief engineer, this time looking at cesspools in our aging wastewater collection system.
We'd like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave your comments at 808-792-8217. You also can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at The Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation.
If you missed any of this show or want a past one, find them on the Conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under Talk Shows for The Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.